Okay, thank you for inviting me to this workshop. I had a choice between old work that was pertinent to this workshop and newer one that was not, and I chose the latter. There is a little sliver of, there is some little overlap with what we are doing in these days, though. I would be producing for you some generalizations of the DBI action, and in particular, generalization of the DBI action, the Dirac-Born-Imfeld, that have an n equals 2 supersymmetry broken to n equals 1. And that can be understood as the infrared limit of theories with n equals 2 supersymmetry. So this is the plan of the talk. Well, gives a concrete realization of n equals 2 broken to n equals 1. And then they show that in the low energy limit, that particular example, so it's a theory that is quite normal in the UV, in the infrared gives actually the n equals 1 generalization of the Born-Imfeld Lagrangian. And then I'll come to the main topic, the generalization to the case where there are many of the objects that I had at high energy, vector multiplets. And then when I have many vector multiplets, I'll ask the problem that's the hardest one in a sense, how to find when two models are equivalent under field redefinition. And for that, I'll show that there is a very nice algebraic geometry story. In particular, I will study the case where we have two vector multiplets and three vector multiplets, which are already surprisingly complicated. I'll explain some properties of these solutions of this for two and three vector multiplets, and then here is the overlap. I will sketch what's needed to do a causality analysis and how different it is in the UV versus the infrared, and then I'll summarize. Okay, so Antoniadis, Partouche, and Taylor in 95 had a very simple, very concrete model in global supersymmetry where an n equals 2 supersymmetry is broken spontaneously to n equals 1. The one thing that they needed, it was just a single multiplet of n equals 2, what is called a vector multiplet. If you think of this vector multiplet of n equals 2 as superfields of n equals 1, then it's two superfields, what we call an n equals 1 vector multiplet and an n equals 1 chiral multiplet. And the Lagrangian is explicitly written in an explicitly n equals 1 language. So if you look at this, you wouldn't know immediately that's n equals 2. You would know that it's n equals 1 because there are, here you have what we call a D term and an F term, so an integral over all superspace and all the chiral half of the superspace. But the fact that it's also n equals 2 comes because the form of this Lagrangian is not the most general possible. Instead of having an arbitrary function of x and x bar, here you have a very specific function, and which is determined in terms of an analytic function of the coordinate x, indeed a cubic, and the same function appears also in the coupling in the subject over here that determines the kinetic terms of the gauge fields. So the example of APT involves a very simple choice of the function u, which is some complex coupling constant, times x cubed. Yep.
I'm just confused because the papers were written on linear
functions. Yes, there was more specifically a DBI. In a sense, this is the a linear realization that at low energies reduces to a DBI. Yeah, this one is not a sigma model yet. I mean, it's just an n equals one theory that's secretly n equals one. But you can, we'll see here how it reduces to a DBI model. And the point is that the APT theory, contains both massless and massive degrees of freedom. And in the infrared, reduces just to the massless sector. That's the Golestino sector for the partial breaking of n equals 2 to n equals 1. So now, since you... Yes, exactly. So now you see the Golestino is an entire multiplet, and it's a vector multiplet, actually. So... this can be seen by looking at the equations of motion that read very neat in superspace. Then you have to go through the pain of writing it in components. Again, M and E are some parameters that you add to your theory. You can relate them if you think of this theory as coming from higher dimensions to some electric and magnetic fluxes, but that's not relevant for what we are doing. Let's take this thing at face value. Now, if you set to zero the fermions to understand what this equation means, and you look at the, you see, this is a multiplet of equations, so you look at the theta square component, it's a, set to zero the fermions, and you get this equation. G here is the field strength of the vector inside the vector multiplet. F is the auxiliary field of the chiral multiplet, so it's the object that has algebraic equations of motion, well, can be solved algebraically. In particular, these algebraic equations of motion are very simple here because they have this phase, and you see everything is algebraic in terms of the field strength and the of the vector multiplet, and then you have derivative terms.
Because in that story, in Palczynski's story, the explanation why is it possible? Because there were central charges coming from translation.
Oh, I abolished those transparencies for sake of time. But yes, same thing. I mean, there is
five-dimensional theory, right? So
no, but you see the point. Well, actually, I can reconstruct these transparencies actually. So let me go back. How is it? Well, probably I have to double click on this, no chance.
Well, we receive.
Huh? Yeah, okay, great. So you see if you write a supersymmetry algebra, rigid supersymmetry algebra, you have the usual term. This is the current algebra, right? Because formally the charge algebra does not exist in terms of operators, blah, blah. Okay. And then you have this extra term. This is the Hughes-Ponchinsky term, if you want. Which is constant, it's just a constant. So you have an extra term in the current algebra, and this actually translates in the fact that when you write the equations that relate the fermion shifts to the energy, or in this case to the potential, you get this extra term, and you see that without it, this equation, if you either have V equals zero or not, if V is equal to zero, all supersymmetries are preserved. If V is non-zero, they're all broken. But with C, this matrix can have one zero eigenvalue and one non-zero. And so you can have partial breaking.
And this comes from boundary terms?
Now, in this theory, it comes from the action.
So you need to iterate in Y there because there are other terms like Schwinger terms?
But I mean, you want to get something that is as close as possible at a current charge, and also because it simplifies some of the formulas, because you may have Siegel terms that integrate to zero. So, and at the end, you remember that the argument for spontaneous breaking, the Witten theorem of all or nothing, relied on charges. So. If you want to mimic it and then be careful about whether these charges exist, you just do the integration. It's just for convenience.
Sorry, what is all or nothing?
So the point is that if you take the supersymmetry algebra, the commutator of two charges, AB, is equal to delta AB times energy, right? So either energy is zero or non-zero. If it's non-zero, the Q applied to the... to the vacuum gives you a Goldstone state, and then the symmetry is broken.
But the relevant central charges always have some tensorial indices, so you always need some effect, the main ball, monopole.
It's not a central charge, that's the point, right?
Yes.
It's not a central charge. I mean, when you integrate in the second variable, when you do what you are not supposed to do when you break supersymmetry, so instead of just integrating in Y, you integrate also on the coordinate of the other current, you'll get infinity. Right. I mean, the term C would be multiplied just by the volume and will diverge.
Okay.
So it's really a contact term, or a Siegel, as it was called. So let's see. We have the equations of motion. The derivative terms are negligible when you look at the far infrared of your theory. So you go below all the mass scales, below the lowest mass scale of your theory. And then you are left with an equation that's purely algebraic. Now, this equation, actually, when you solve for it for F, and you plug the solution back in the Lagrangian, gives you a Lagrangian whose bosonic part is remarkably simple. It's just the one of these constants that you introduced in the definition of the model, the imaginary part of one of such constants, times the auxiliary field. But then when you solve for F, you will get an interesting action, right? Instead of just writing down the action, now I can tell you a slightly different story. I can say that we can do better, and instead of looking at the bosonic part of the equations of motion, I can actually solve supersymmetrically, so express an entire multiplet, in this case the chiral multiplet, in terms of another multiplet, the vector multiplet, better, the field strength of the vector multiplet, and then get a fully superspace relation, and then from that I can get, if I want, the complete action with all the fermion terms. This is to do that is useful to take the chiral multiplet and shift it about its expectation value, right? So shift x as some other chiral multiplet plus a number, which obeys this relation. This is also the stationary point for the potential. And then you notice that it's convenient to work in the, we are interested really in the infrared behavior of this theory to the decoupling limit where you select the infrared is where the masses of all my particles go to infinity, and that's achieved by setting this object larger than that. So that's simply because the definition of the mass is the ratio of the two. Okay. So in that limit, actually, some terms drop out of the equations of motion, and you get a self-consistent solution of the equations of motion, supersymmetric equations of motion, written in this elegant way, which has various properties. If you look at these equations and you look at the highest term, it will be what we wrote before. It will be an equation that expresses, an equation whose bosonic part expresses the auxiliary field F as a function of the field strength. The lowest component of this equation is this one, and it tells me that the lowest component of the chiral multiplet Y is actually is written as a bilinear in the fermions of the vector multiplet, which implies, because of Firth's identities, that Y is nilpotent and Y times W is equal to zero. These equations are quite reminiscent of the equations used to define the Goldstone theory in a generic n equals 1 supersymmetry broken to n equals 0. This was done by the Firenze group, by Casalbuoni and other, and was rediscovered by Seiberg and Komargowski. They defined their Goldstone field written in n equals 1 superspace in terms of nilpotent fields. So we have this nilpotent field. Okay, but we are, what is the action? We say that it's this. Well, when you substitute what F is, you get a complicated action. Its bosonic part, if we can recognize, is a Born-Infeld action. So here we have a theory which, if you want, the low-energy action has two faces. On the one hand, it is, the, in a sense, the N equals 1 generalization of the Golestino action, of the Folkov-Akulov action, that describes just the Goldstone sector, or the Golestino sector in this case, associated with the partial supersymmetry breaking. But this action is also an n equals 1 Born-Infeld theory. Right? So the aim of the talk is actually to find if we can generalize the story in which we start with a UV theory that it's normal, it's just a bunch of vector multiplets and chiral multiplets, and it's n equals 2, and derive a multi-field generalization of a Born-Infeld action, which depends only on the vector multiplet and whose bosonic part is an algebraic function of the field strength. And what kind of theories do we get there?
So I didn't get why you get the Born-Infeld. I mean, I understand that you get the Born-Infeld, but why do you
change? Oh, the Born-Infeld comes simply from actually solving this equation. Yeah. I mean, for the bosonic part, you can just solve that equation.
No symmetry argument.
Or a geometric interpretation?
There could be, but I mean, in a sense, the way in which maybe it's more clear in the way in which Hughes and Polchinski got it, because then they had the picture in terms of brains moving in extra dimensions. Then there, you know, just the volume term is a Born-Infeld. Now, why it's a Born-Infeld in G and not in the
so this brain was actually break n equal 2 down to n.
Yeah, that was done in 86. okay, so there are other generalizations of to N fields, For instance, Ascheri, Bray, Moriaro, and Zumino did one. Our possesses what I can call a little bit unprecisely a linearly realized n equals to SUSY in the ultraviolet, in the sense that in the ultraviolet you have just an n equals to spectrum and n equals to hard interactions. So what we do is exactly that. We write an n equals to theory written in n equals one superfield language, which contains now n abelian vector multiplets and then chiral multiplets. And then so how do we write it? In this case, the fact that the theory is n equals two is encoded in the fact that to define the theory, you need only one object, a holomorphic function of the chiral multiplets. Normally in n equals one, you need a Keller potential and a superpotential. Here you need a holomorphic prepotential, which I write here in this way. I have just quadratic and cubic terms in the fields X, and the quadratic term is often needed to ensure positivity of the kinetic terms for our theory. It's not needed in the case of one field X, but in general, when you have more than one, it may be needed. Not always, but it may be needed. And this cubic term comes because you can think of it in various terms. You can say that this comes by imposing a shift symmetry in the field X. Or you can think of the fact that you can think of this n equals two theories as coming from n equals one in six dimensions, doing a dimensional reduction to four dimensions. The extra components of the gauge fields now become the X. And then at this point, since the non-derivative interactions of the gauge fields are fixed, you get automatically a cubic potential.
I have a better question. So because in Palczynski's example, the actual nonlinearized symmetry was high dimensional superponderable, right? And you also get DBI here. So in your case, is it just four dimensional superponderable?
It's all four dimensional. I mean, you don't need to think of it as coming from
a... But actual symmetry, which is nonlinearized, is it four dimensional?
Oh, it's four dimensional, yes. It's just four dimensional n equals
so,
one.
So this DBI is not related to some high dimensional, because that's usually what it comes from. There, in Palczynski's example, it comes from
Not in a way that I'm aware of. That doesn't, it may be actually, but because after all, a Falkov-Akulov action is unique, right? Yes. Up to Fiedler definition, right. so they must be the same.
But
it's not obvious. I mean, you can still stay in four dimensions and forget about. Yeah, indeed, that's... I mean, this was well known. I mean, this N-field generalization that's...
Yeah, but in terms of explaining why it is... I thought she explained why it was...
It's possible. So, when you have... So, one single cubic... polynomial with real coefficients. The d are real. So the leading term, the cubic term, has real coefficients. That will play a role in our analysis. This is the Lagrangian that we get, right? Written in n equals one language. Right? As in the case of one multiplet, now I have to use lowercase n, it's convenient to shift the chiral, to study the equation of motion, it's convenient to shift the chiral multiplets so that you write them in terms of some field with VEV equal to zero around the vacuum plus some constant, plus the VEV. They have to obey this equation. So again, here you see that before you had just one parameter E and one parameter M. Here you have a bunch, and you have to be sure that actually, for instance, you can you have n equals one supersymmetry. I mean, if you choose this E and M not wisely, you may break to n equals zero. We don't want that. We want to have still an n equals one. So we have to find m and e that allow for solving this equation. Okay, equations of motion for the field x or equivalently y. Again, here we are looking at a limit where we look at the infrared, the couple higher masses, and this also is achieved by setting the third derivative of u, which is the symbol d, being larger than u will be computed at the stationary point. In that limit, some pieces in the equations of motion drop out, and one is left with an equation that's an obvious generalization of what we saw before. Now, I claim that there is a self-consistent answer that solves the equation I gave you in the infrared limit, when you can neglect derivative terms. And it is given by asking that the fields y are obey some nilpotency constraints. Now, the nilpotency constraint is no longer y squared, but it's 2y multiplied by this symbol dabc. Remember, dabc is symmetric by construction. And y times the field strength of the vector multiplet times the same symbol are both equal to zero. Under those conditions, so when those two conditions are obeyed, actually the equations of motion further simplifies and reduces to what I wrote here. Now, and this equation gives us the Born-Infeld action. Now, why the answer is self-consistent? Well, the answer is self-consistent because when you solve, look at this equation, look at the lowest term. This, remember, this is a superfield, so it has a bosonic component, a theta component, and a theta square component. It's a chiral superfield. The lowest component, the bosonic component, says that y is some y times some number is equal to the lowest component of these two w's. The lowest component of w are fermions, which I call w alpha. So you have, I called them lambda before. I don't know why I changed. So you have two lambdas here, right? Which means that y is quadratic in the in these fermions, right? In the fermions w. Now, substitute back into your equation, into these constraints, do you get zero? Well, yes, you get zero, and basically that's due to just a good old Fields identity, right? Nothing more than that. For any values of, say, ABC. Because remember, I mean, it's really a Landau-Lischitz exercise, right? This, you have three indices that run from one to n, and they are symmetrized. Right, and then you have three fermions to ensure total anti-symmetrization. Alpha, beta, and gamma must be anti-symmetrized, but alpha, beta, and gamma run from 1 to 2, so you get 0. Why it's the Born-Infeld action? And now here you look at the highest component of the supersymmetric equation. Drop the fermion terms just to get the bosonic part of your theory, and you get exactly this nonlinear equation for F that expresses the field F as a function of the field, the auxiliary field F in terms of the field strength of your vector multiplet. Right? When you solve these equations, you'll get, if you can solve them, you will get a complicated non-polynomial function of this G. And though the solution explicitly is quite complicated, in the infrared limit, when you plug back the auxiliary fields, et cetera, the action has a simple form. The form that I gave before for one field can be massaged into others. In particular, what is useful here is this expression. Why? Because here it's evident that you have that the positivity of the kinetic term for these W's depends on u. In particular, depends on the value of the second derivative of the prepotential computed at the minimum. So this is the quantity that at the end we want to be sure that's positive. Right. To avoid ghosts. The theory has two SUSYs, the two supersymmetries. The second one actually can be identified by looking at how the remember, at low energies, there is only a vector multiplet. So we look at how, say, the fermion in the vector multiplet transforms under supersymmetry. And then this identifies the Goldstino multiplet and also allows us to write the supersymmetry breaking scale in terms of the parameters of our theory. So choose. So you see that, in particular, you want this product to be non-zero, right? Because otherwise, you'll have n equals 2 supersymmetry. Now, the more interesting part of the story is that now we have a bunch of theories classified by two data, by this symmetric three-index symbol, D, and by a quadratic, by a tensor, a CIB. And we want to see when, in which cases we are simply rewriting the same theory in terms of different fields. Right? So we want to find a way of classifying the truly inequivalent theories that contain n vector multiplets.
Yeah. For these choices of dimensionalities and the charges, is the analog of Green-Schwarz in this Bessonian term, which relates to capacitive
actions? Well, I mean, here, actually, no, right? Because at the end, I mean, remember, a Green-Schwarz term in four dimensions would be, say, GG tilde scalar, but in the in the low energy theory, well, I mean, okay, I see what is, you see, what you say. Yeah, there is also a term of that form in the UV theory. Right? In the UV theory, there is a GG tilde times a scalar. When you go to the infrared, you have no scalars, and then you end up with just vectors, right? Vectors and their fermionic partners. But yeah, in higher dimensions, indeed, you choose this cubic also gives you some Green-Schwarz terms. And also, as you know, this the fact of choosing a cubic potential comes from various reasons. The fact that there is a shift symmetry tells you that you have axions, so you have these Green-Schwarz fields. It comes from also string compactifications, etc. This is not directly related to this, but yeah, the reason why we chose, for instance, a cubic action was precisely to have this shift symmetry. One of the reasons why. Also because in this case you have a neat problem that tells you how many independent theories there are. In particular, the interactions and the constraints, as you saw before, really do not depend on that matrix of quadratic terms, so only in the cubic term. So the first question to ask is how many inequivalent interactions there are up to nonlinear field redefinitions. In the infrared, when you look at the effective theory, the theory only depends on this D. So how many different theories there are in the infrared, right? The solution is known actually for only for two vector multiplets and three vector multiplets. For n equals so, four, there are partial results in the mathematical literature. And in general, when I asked an algebraic geometrist about the problem for general n, the answer was forget about it. Okay, so there are two related problems when you classify inequivalent theories. One is to find canonical forms for the qubit, right? So you say you have a theory, you have only a certain finite number of canonical forms. The second is to find invariants that characterize inequivalent theories. You're given a generic cubic, two generic cubics, are they equivalent or not? You need some invariants that you can compute. When they match, they are equivalent. When they are different, they're not.
So this would be the analog, let's say, of a discriminant for a...
Yes, indeed. It would be the analog of a discriminant, and which has surprisingly big ramifications when you go beyond just the discriminant. Which here we just barely used, but it's true. Now, the simplest case is two vector multiplets. In the case of two vector multiplets, you have a cubic polynomial with real coefficients, and you can, to preserve the reality condition, you can do redefinitions of GL2R, right? And so how do you write the most generic homogeneous cubic polynomial? Well, in this way, like you have three roots. U is the product of x minus root y. ABC can be all real, or one can be real, and the other two can be complex conjugate. Right? And then it's if you classify inequivalent polynomials up to a GL2R transformation, the problem is very simple. If the three roots are real and distinct, you can put them in three at, say, 1, 0, and minus 1 in the real axis. Right? And then you get this canonical form for the potential. If they are, if two roots are complex conjugate, then you can choose these three roots to be the cubic roots of unity with, again, a GL2R transformation. And then you have the cases where two roots are equal or three roots are equal, which give these degenerate cases. So that's the list. There is nothing else. Now you come to the second part of the story, find the discriminant. In the case of, already in the case of two vectors, this is not totally trivial. This is essentially is almost the Cayley hyperdeterminant that was introduced again by Cayley, and that keeps popping up in various fields in theoretical physics, in entanglement of qubits, et cetera, et cetera. So it periodically reappears. As you see, it's already for two fields, the story is not totally trivial. You have this object that you wouldn't guess at first sight. All the cases that I showed actually can be determined by this hyperdeterminant. The case of three real roots is I4 larger than zero, I4 less than zero. And then the degenerate cases have this determinant equal to zero. And the most degenerate of all has the determinant and the derivative with respect to the D symbols equal to zero. By the way, in this case, GL2R has a trivial part of scaling and then SL2R. So the problem that you are classifying is also physically classifying the orbits of a spin 3 half representation. And now, in the, because you have you know, two indices, the A and B are two indices, D are symmetric, right? So you have just a symmetric function of three spinor indices. Now, in the case of these two fields, you can also very, you can immediately write the independent quadratic terms that you can add to your theory. Of course, you don't want to write terms that can be eliminated by shifting either X or Y, and then this means that you have very few possibilities for case A, B, C, and D, you see that the quadratic term that you can add depends on one or at most two parameters. And that's it. You have completed the classification. The case, already the case of three vectors is more interesting. You have a cubic homogeneous polynomial. You want to find orbits modulo GL3R transformations. For that, you need a little bit of projective geometry. You have a cubic in three real variables, and it's homogeneous. So this defines projectively a curve on the plane. If you worked on the complex, that would be a genus one surface, right? So for the reals, you have just you have three homogeneous coordinates, two normal coordinates, and then one relation, so you have a curve. And then so what this curve can do is a cubic on the plane, right? The curve could be non-degenerate and never intersect, this is the case in which not all the derivatives of this cubic are zero on the curve. Right? And then in that case, you know that the curve, you can prove that the curve has many flexes, has at least three, indeed more. You can choose these three of them to sit on a particular line, which is this. And then you get a canonical form that I wrote here, where now instead of having just one canonical form, you also have a modulus, this sigma, that can take all real values except minus one half. So this is the non-degenerate case. You have a family of inequivalent curves classified by this modulus sigma. And then you have the singular cases. One possibility is that the curve is irreducible and singular, so you have either a cusp or the curve self-intersects, and you have three possibilities according to the sign of the Hessian, the matrix of the second derivatives of U at the intersection, and these are classified this time by a number that can be either zero plus or minus one. And then you proceed, reducible times, the curve could be reducible, so it could be the product of a quadratic polynomial times a line, like a linear polynomial. If the quadratic has this face, well, this form is invariant under SO3. With SO3, you can take your line and decide that has that is this one, and move it to this value. It could be SO2-1, then you see that a line could be space-like, time-like, or null, right? You can always, using SO2-1, move any time-like curve to be exactly this, any space like to be this, and then in normal down, right? And then you have all several other reducible cases in which you have three lines. They could be non-concurrent, non-concurrent and real, non-concurrent complex conjugate, concurrent, real, complex conjugate, or coincide, have two lines that coincide, one that doesn't, or three that coincide. And actually in this case, I'll have some picture to exemplify these cases, but so you see, you have a classification. It's already non-trivial at these stages, you see. I mean, it's an exercise in projective geometry, but it's not totally trivial.
What does concurrent mean?
Concurrent means that the three meet at the same point. So you see, this doesn't meet at the same point because this is the line at infinity. So you have x, y, and the line at infinity. So they meet pairwise, but the three never meet at the same point.
In relation to the classification,
because it's probably the derivatives. Well, with the cubics, not directly, because I think that the ADE is related to normal forms of polynomials, but you always end with something times x to the k, where k is larger than one. So, but I mean, this field can, I mean, and all this story of how to generalize determinants and discriminants actually can become very big. And again, probably if you want to do something already for n equals 4 or 5, you would need a machinery that's maybe too much for what it's worth. Now, you also have invariants that classify the various inequivalent cases. I don't try them explicitly because they start to be really complicated. There are two invariants, one that is a quartic in the symbol D and one that is sextic, and then is the equivalent of the Cayley hyperdeterminant is of something of order 12. And all the singular cases are classified by the vanishing of what I call this I-12. You can also classify all the degenerate cases by looking at the other two invariants that make this discriminant and derivatives of these other two variables. Again, the classification starts to be complicated, so instead of giving it explicitly, I'll give you just a graphic summary of the various cases. This is a bit cheating. This works on the complex where the classification is simple because, you know, when you have a single case in the complex, a single, say, quartic, right, that may correspond to different real quartics. But here you have, so these are all the singular cases. You could have an intersection, a node, or a cusp. Again, this intersection splits in two cases on the real. But when you have a quadratic times a line, the line could cross the quadratic or be tangent. And then again, here are the cases that I showed before. Three lines non-concurrent, three concurrent lines, two lines that are the same, are overlapping, and one that's not, and all the three that are overlapping. So, and then when you, again, there are when you go to the reals, you have to distinguish some cases that are the same over the complex. And if you, for our amusement, here is actually a summary table of all the singular cases. So here you have the classification over the complex, here the classification over the real, here is the normal form of the polynomial. These are all the singular cases, right? And then the values of all the invariants that I told you about before on the various singular cases. You see that. So I-12 is zero for all the cases, but in some instances, there are invariants that are non-zero, and then you arrive to the truly, totally, the most degenerate case where all the invariants vanish. This is just an exercise. So if you want to know, for instance, given two actions that depend on three vector multiplets, and I give you two superpotentials, are the superpotential equivalent or not? Well, look at the invariants, look at this table, and you can decide. Right? So
it's very special way to then use. This table.
Well, I mean, we are at perimeter. Now, about further developments. The equations for the auxiliary fields can be solved actually for n equals 2 and n equals 3. And you may be surprised about n equals 3. Because if you recall, we have a set of three equations, right, that are quadratic, each of them, you may expect that when you reduce to a single equation, you'll get an equation of order 8, which cannot be solved by algebraic means. But actually, surprisingly, by going to the normal forms, even in the case of three vector multiplets, you never encounter equations that are more than quadratic. And the quadratic are also, sorry, quartic, but the quartic are also very special type. So you can solve explicitly the equations that determine the Born-Infeld-like Lagrangian. You can solve for the auxiliary fields F in terms of the field strength. The answer may not be totally illuminating, so I just give you an example. Good luck, right? So at the end, you can plug this thing in the action, And this is expressed in terms of certain variables that are determined in terms of certain other variables that are determined in terms of certain other variables that are solutions of a fourth order equation, et cetera, et cetera. So can you, so if you want, the link to this meeting is, can you find whether this theory has superluminal propagation or not? I mean, it would be a bit hard, right? So indeed, it's so hard that you may say that this is a case in which going to the ultraviolet helps, because then when you study the problem in the ultraviolet, you have an action where you have just a standard action with a standard prepotential. And the only thing that you have to check is the positivity of the kinetic terms for the various fields, right? So you have to check if you want the characteristic matrix, right? So which is determined by the kinetic terms. And there are certain cases actually in which you do not need to add these quartic terms. You remember, we started with a cubic, but then we say to get positivity of the kinetic term, you need to add some, sorry, not quartic, some quadratic terms, right? Some term that depend on, say, x, y, etc. There are cases in which this is not necessary, so there are ranges of values for this and forms for the prepotential where that's not necessary. But studying these cases is infinitely simpler than studying what I showed you in the previous transparency, because at the end, if you what you have to study, say, for this object is take the matrix of second derivatives, take the Hessian, determine whether the Hessian is positive, and that can be done by studying just three objects, right? The determinant of the Hessian, the and the two leading principal minors, right? I mean, the so you have to take the determinant, the minor made with the first two rows and first two columns, and then the first element. All the three have to be positive. If they are positive, the matrix is positive, and you are done, right? So it's much simpler. This is called Sylvester's criterion, who made a lot of discovered a lot of nice results in algebraic geometry. It was worth all the $6,000 per year that he was paid in the 1800s. It was the most paid scientist in America. Now, again, as I said before, is the signal propagation subluminal? Well, in the UV theory, you can study the problem and answer, right? I mean, you have, after all, a very simple theory, quite standard. You just look at the kinetic terms and you're done. In the infrared, I don't know. I mean, I really have no idea. I wouldn't even try to attempt it. So this is a case, again, in which it pays to have an underlying theory. Other developments. As I said before, they can be these equations for auxiliary fields can be solved algebraically. Now, there is a thing that's mysterious. I don't understand it. It was found by Yerevanian and Sagnotti, actually, by doing some explicit calculations in several cases. And it's the following. Precisely when you do not need the quadratic term to get positivity of the action, you can you'll discover that the electric field created by point sources is bounded. You know, this was one of the nice properties of the Born-Imfeld. And here it holds also in these more general cases, but when you don't need a quadratic term. Why? We don't know. The classification of the n equals 4 case is doable, but it has not yet been fully done in the mathematical literature. So here you have four variables, right, and one equation. So you get on the reals a surface of dimension 2, and on the complex you get actually a surface of dimension 4. And what has been done is a classification over the complex of the various topological types of the surface. But there is no complete classification yet. It's an interesting fact that something that seems so simple can be a very hard problem. And again, that's the last thing that I wanted to mention. So what we did, we proposed a multifield extension of Born-Imfeld that possesses a hidden n equals 2 supersymmetry and a simple ultraviolet completion. It arises as an infrared limit of this n equals 2 theory broken spontaneously. The classification of inequivalent theories is a non-trivial algebraic geometry problem. It's solvable only for low number of multiplets. And again, the properties, the causal properties of this theory are relatively easy to check in the ultraviolet, but difficult to check in the infrared theory. And that's it.
by the last line, you mean that you didn't even check. It's not that there is
no.
a non-trivial something
no.
in the infrared in which it looks like it's supernumeral, but it's
I really, given that form of the action, I would not know where to begin.
You are really disappointed.
When it matters.